Ladies and gentlemen, it's about time to think about getting started on our question session. And first, I have a little housekeeping to do. Our speaker next week is Adele Boucher-Rims. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. The title is, Should Alberta Be Kept Free of Nuclear Power? And for those who won't be able to get to the SACPA talk, like me, she will also be speaking the evening before to a special SACPA session at University of Lethbridge. That talk will be free, but not lunch, just coffee and snacks. And I'd like to remind you all that SACPA does have a website. It provides information on past and future sessions, including audio recordings of our presentations and our question and answer sessions. You can also submit comments there on presentations. Keep the discussion going if you wish. And there's also a suggestion box outside the room here, I understand, where you can put in written comments or complaints if you have any of those. Now, our topic today was energy, environment, and economy, discovering Alberta's future. Our speaker was Dr. David Lazell. It's time for questions. We've got a microphone for questioners over here. And remember to keep your comments brief and get on with your questions. No long dissertations, please. And please, no questions from the floor, because we want to record your questions and the answers so we can put them on that website. David, the podium is yours again, and I don't see anybody lined up with questions yet, but there must be lots.
Thank you. My name is Joseph Natuk. I'm a recent immigrant from Saskatchewan. They're all my life.
It's some other Saskatchewan out here. Yeah.
And as you know, we have a lot of uranium, we have a lot of agriculture, and a whole bunch of things, and probably some oil sands in the future. So my question is going to be very simple. I want to, you talk about using waste or presumably straw and so on for future energy production. My question is, regarding that process, what's going to happen if you continue over the next 50 years to use that straw, which is now, most of it is being recycled back into the soil to make it, productive. I was just wondering, has anybody really looked at it, the long-term impacts of that kind of a situation? And just before I leave, is that a real picture of the polar bear?
My understanding, yes.
that's an award winner.
I did find it on the internet. So, the issue on soil carbon and is a very important one. There have been a number of people looking at it, and it's absolutely true that you cannot take all the straw that you might get from a crop. As a matter of fact, you got to leave a significant portion behind. And on bad years, or years of low crop production, then you have to leave virtually all of it behind. And one of the big challenges in agriculture in taking the straw, and there's a number of studies, Ag Canada is probably the expert in this, is in Ag Canada, is look at how much can you take. On a really bumper crop year, you can take 75% of the straw and not have to, and you'd still build soil carbon pools. But on a lousy year, where it's been drought, and you'd have to leave a significant, you'd virtually have to leave all of it behind. So there's a problem there in reliability of supply year to year. This is where forestry has some real advantages, and I think that some of the things that we can do is we can look at riparian areas, because I think what you want to do is to try to address the issues of energy alongside of other environmental issues, water use, nutrients flowing in from into rivers and into streams, and eutrophication of lakes and algal blooms, etc. And I think there's opportunities to perhaps look at perennial biomass crops in riparian areas that would have deep roots, that would sop up the nutrients before they get into the water stream, that would stimulate the growth of the trees, and then every few years you come, and maybe every 3 to 5 years you come and take it. Could be willow, could be other sorts of poplar trees, etc. And I think, or aspen, something that it would be ideal if you could just cut it down and it resprouts. I think there's, as soon as we start putting a value on the energy value of biomass, there's lots of technologies which I think will come forward. New crops we looked at. I think we have a real opportunity here to not do monoculture, to look at prairie grasses, for example, and what they might be able to contribute. So, and I think the ecological sustainability of this is a very important filter and criteria. It's not just taking the carbon, because if you did it, we'll do a rape and pillage, and we'll be worse off than where we are now.
My name is Pat Greenlee. I'm wondering if we take this biomass and produce gas and put it into the gas pipelines, the natural gas pipelines that are existing, do we have an obligation under NAFTA to ship a certain percentage of that south? And so I'm wondering, in order to meet Canada's requirements for fuel, are we going to have to produce way more so that we can ship a bunch of it south?
Well, in our natural gas today, we ship about 50% of the natural gas we produce in Canada. 50% goes south because we produce a lot of natural gas in Canada. I'm not positive about the details of NAFTA, but my understanding is that if there was an, we have to continue to provide natural gas to United States. If there is a shortage, we have to continue to provide them that amount. I'm not sure whether it's a percent or whether it's a number of cubic meters. And what would happen if we dramatically increase the amount of natural gas we produce? Do they always have to have, right of first refusal on a certain percentage of it? I don't have an answer to that question. I think it's an important one, for sure. But I think part of the issue is that we actually have a bit of a surplus supply. I mean, natural gas prices are down under $7 a gigajoule now, where they were up to 12 or 13. So we've got, we actually are producing in North America more, and there's a lot of new, what they call tight gas, shale gas coming online, and that is producing. So the question is, what do we want to use the natural gas for? And I think that this is where the energy, North American energy strategy, and I think it would be very nice if we had a Canadian energy strategy. That would be very nice. But I think we also have to think about where we are within the North America system, because I think what we will be seeing is Canada be looked to provide the energy environmental solutions, and we need to make sure that just look at where our pipelines go. There's no pipelines go east-west, except the natural gas one. The oil pipelines go right into the United States. And I think that we need to figure, we need to have that worked into our plans of where we're going as Alberta, as Canada, and indeed as North America. I would argue that we don't have answers to some of the critical questions of what our energy system needs to look like in 2030. I don't think it makes sense for us to think 2050, because we could be talking about massive changes in technology by 2050. But 2030, we're talking about technologies that more or less exist today or are very close to being introduced. And that's, we can look at to 2030. Yes.
I'm Trevor Page. I'm a little concerned with what you said about the need for an integrated North American energy policy or plan. We had Gordon Laxer of Parklands here last year telling us that actually, and telling the government in Ottawa, we actually needed a Canadian energy policy more than anything first. Yes. I mean, don't you think there's a danger that if there's an integrated North American plan, we'll just get sucked up and we'll be just a supplier to the United States? And related to that, do you include Mexico as part of the North American energy plan? And we just had, if I might add, Gwynne Dyer addressing people here in Lethbridge about his new book, Climate Wars, where he predicts that we're all going, I mean, we, meaning the planet, is going to starve to death. So whether we will have the luxury of even growing biomass is a big question.
Okay, I think three very good questions there that I counted. Let me see if I can address them one at a time. One is, you know, it's 11 years ago, I started to work on looking at the role of biological systems in addressing climate change and energy. For the last 11 years, we've heard excuse after excuse of why we haven't done anything on the climate change file, and it's because the Americans haven't done it. And the Americans don't have decided, especially when Bush came in 8 years ago, that they decided that they weren't going to be playing in the Kyoto game, and so Canada, we use that for not putting a lot of carbon trading programs, etc., in. If we're going to address, and the energy security as well, I mean, we have an integrated energy plan. Our oil pipelines go right into the United States. All of eastern Canada is reliant either on, right now, on oil from the Middle East. We have our NAFTA agreement, which integrates, locks the two countries together. I think all of the evidence that I've seen in the last 10 years is to think that we can be an island within our... Look at what's happened. It's a collapse of the American financial system, not the Canadian financial system, and that's having reverberations through Canada. Every time a storm hits in the Gulf Coast, down south, our oil and our gas prices go up. So we have an integrated energy system. We might wish that we didn't. We might wish that we could do it, but I would argue that we need to address the energy security climate change issue. We have a new administration in the United States. We have a new government in Ottawa with another four-year mandate, or three and a half, depending on how you see it. But anyhow, and I think that we've got, this is the time that we need to be looking at it. The fact is that I think in these negotiations, we've got a lot of very good cards in negotiation. And I have very same concerns as a Canadian about the nature of those negotiations and whether we can truly win. But if they don't win, if we can't win and it can't be a real benefit, then I think we should not proceed. We still have the North American Free Trade Agreement that we can fall back on. In terms of bioenergy, I think that we've got an issue in Canada in terms of bioenergy, and this is sort of like the silver lining on a very dark cloud. And the dark cloud is an example of this is the mountain pine beetle in British Columbia. The number of trees that were killed by mountain pine beetle, which is a climate impact, right, of the beetles surviving winter kill because the winters have been so warm for so many years. We're going to see more and more of that kind of damage. Are we just going to walk away from those trees and basically let a forest fire take them out? There's enough, the dead wood in British Columbia, we did a number of studies on this in BioCap, worked very closely with the BC government. There's enough energy in the dead trees that were killed in the last 10 years to provide 100% of Canada's energy needs for a year. I'm not suggesting we actually could take that, but I think there is we'd be able to access all of that, but there is a huge amount. And I think that we need to put that into the mix, because what we need to do is when we have to be thinking about changing helping our forests adapt to the climate change. Letting the same mountain pine beetle species grow up in a monoculture over 12 million, 11 million hectares of land doesn't make sense in the long run. Because there are trees that are adapted for the climate of the last 100, 200 years, not the climate of the next 50 to 100 years. We need to be thinking about changing our forest management policies. We need to be thinking about getting in there and taking that biomass and getting energy systems out. We've got to be thinking strategically in a very different world in the future than the world in the past.
Okay.
Bob Anderson, you made reference, I didn't get the full title, but to a watchdog. You kept talking about some watchdog. What is it? Who is it? How does it work? What does it watch? Who is it responsible to?
Okay.
What's all that stuff about?
All right. It's the International Energy Agency, IEA. It's a product of the, I think it reports through to the OECD. It's an OECD, the Organization of Economic Development and Cooperation. which is all of the major developed countries of the world. And their job, they've been looking at sort of a major and economic and energy, the IEA is the energy piece on the OECD, as I understand it, but we need to check. It's one of probably the best known groups looking at international energy, and in a sense fairly high, it's highly respected. So that's why. And when it says something, it tends to carry weight. And I think in the past, it's been pretty optimistic about the world's ability to continue to produce ever more increasing amounts of oil to meet increasing demands. Certainly the signals in the last few months have been that it feels that it's perhaps overestimated in the past. And I think we'll find out next week when the report comes out how much it has overestimated. But certainly the signals from a lot of sources, and I just showed one paper from Financial Times that suggests that they've overestimated. And so they're actually coming back with a lower estimate. How low it is, I don't know. I've heard rumors it's around 100 million tons a year instead of 116. And that would mean that if we do that, it's going to be constraints once the economy starts to recover. There will start to be constraints on supply demand.
Hi, Doctor. My name is Ken Eichel. I'm very interested in your presentation. It was very good.
Thank you.
And you can see somebody come down and explain things to you. But I have concerns about biomass and for example, you're talking about using wood and fuel and the rainforests in Brazil where they're destroying them down there basically to have their ethanol and
yep.
The biggest producer of ethanol and the use of ethanol and to that so that it doesn't happen somewhere else like in our forests here that they can say, well, we're going to chop them all down mm-hmm. and we're going to use them for methanol. Yep. But there's one thing I'd like to ask you about, it's a GTL, gas to liquid systems, and what is your opinion on that? Because that reduces emissions down farther than even diesel or the octane level is as good or better than diesel or gasoline, and that could be utilized. They're starting to do it, but they're not going. What do you think? That would be for like Alberta, where they could turn their natural gas into GTL.
I think it certainly has to be. Except the issue, though, is it's still a fossil fuel, and when you combust that liquid, it's still going to be carbon emissions into the atmosphere. So we're going to have to address that issue. It's perhaps we got a number of options. We got coal to liquids, we got biomass to liquids, and we got gas to liquids. And if we have a liquid a shortage like of liquid fuels for cars and for transportation because of energy security concerns and because oil, maybe production can't be keep up to demand. I think that we're probably going to see all three of those move forward based on economics. A key piece on this, though, is two of them, the coal to liquids and the gas to liquids, will still have very significant greenhouse gas emissions, when you both in the production of them and in the combustion. There will be some emissions with the biomass to liquids. That's one advantage of the biomass is that if it's managed properly, and I think your comment about the tropical rainforest is a very important one. The issue has to be dealt with as a resource management issue. If we end up cutting down and converting massive amounts of forest into energy production and there's a decrease in the carbon stock of the forest and we're not really doing anything for climate change and we're destroying biodiversity, we need to put rules and regulation and guidance on what are the principles for a bioenergy future. I think the issue in Canada compared to virtually any other country in the world is we have a huge resource. There is just the above ground biomass in Canada's forest is 60 could theoretically provide 65 years of 100% of Canada's energy. It gets replaced about every 65 years, right? And I think what we really want is to design a policy and programs that encourage going into our biological systems and taking out the dead trees and the dead biomass and trying to switch our forests to more living and more vibrant ecosystems. This is going to be a really, so it's really part of an adaptation to climate change, and it's part of a longer, it's a strategy that will help those ecosystems adapt to the impacts of climate impacts like mountain pine beetle. Once a tree is dead, you get it out and use it for energy. And those are the sorts of policies. So I think just having an open field day on biomass would be a disaster, because I think what we would do is, in our record of humans in this, is quite clear that we would have major concerns if we don't regulate.
What do you think about hundreds of thousands of acres of switchgrass?
I think there might be, the challenge is where you're going to grow the switchgrass. I think there's issues of water use, there's issues of if it's taking agricultural land that could be used for food production. Some switchgrass, you can grow switchgrass on areas. There's probably 10 to 15 million hectares at least in Canada of agricultural land that is not used for food production today. One of the switchgrass does have some opportunities. I'm not convinced it's the best one to use. Again, we need to set the criteria. We got to make sure if we're taking out a really great biodiversity and carbon store and moving into switchgrass, I'd have serious concerns. So what it depends on the details of what you're doing. And we need those criteria, absolutely.
I'm Mark Sandilands. Great presentation. My head is spinning with all of the facts that you presented. A comment and a question. You mentioned just now about taking that dead tree out of the forest. The dead tree is part of the ecosystem in the forest. And you take it out and you do disrupt the ecosystem. So that's caution in there. My question is, you talked about a transformative change, and your list of involved faculties include the social science faculty. Is anybody looking at how we're going to change people's behaviors? Because you can have all of these things happening, but if people don't buy into it, then they'll go nowhere. Is there any research in your colleagues over there on that issue?
All right, I'm going to answer the two questions. One on the concern about the forest cutting of trees. I would agree if we actually take it all. What we are, if you were to take the entire tree, especially the lower, smaller branches, and take every strip, every biomass chunk of dead tree out, there's going to be, that's a problem. The challenge we have in many of our forests, especially our forests that are coping with severe climate impacts, is that the amount of deadwood in those forests are going up relative to the regular. And I think that there's an issue of trying to get the trees out so new species can be brought in. And actually, I would argue we not only have to get some of those dead trees out, we have to think about planting species from further south, further north, just so that the trees that grow might be better adapted for the future climate in that area. And we help our ecosystems adapt. So I think it's part of an integrated strategy. I just didn't have time today to talk about all of the constraints on it, but I share your concern. And the issue here is balance, right? We figure out how we got to do it, and we're managing. In terms of the second part was on, remind me again.
The social science.
Oh, the social science. I think that's an absolutely critical. We've actually, I've been at Calgary for 3 months now, and I'm trying to spend as much time as I can understanding who's working on the social science side. There's one group that I am working closely with, and in fact, we got a conference in Calgary on Monday, working with Pembina, and IC is working with a number of the other environmental groups and industry groups, looking at carbon capture and storage and what are the issues there. And part of the question there is public perceptions of carbon capture and storage. What are their concerns? The risk issues. And the risk communications issues. So, how do we address these to inform policymakers? Certainly, yeah, lots on economics, tons on economics. And I think when you get into cities and the way we use energy in our cities, it's probably the biggest question is that carbon efficient communities is an attitude of what do people see as success? Do we all insist that our success is having a hectare of land out with one house on it and a huge, 4,000, 5,000 square foot house with an indoor swimming pool? If that is considered success, and that's what we all strive towards, we're in deep doo-doo. And I think that we have to look at how do we change people's perceptions of what is success and what they should strive for? And I don't have an answer to that, but certainly social scientists need to engage social scientists to help us with those questions.
Art Sanford, and certainly we've got a very complicated subject, very hard to understand, but I guess one of the keys is to reduction of emissions. And I've spent 40-some years in the automotive business and I own a company for many years. Two things, the car you drive today compared to one 40 years ago, the emissions are about 1/50th. That's how much the reduction. So it proves that technology works. And the other thing I learned in business was you work on your successes and don't be afraid to try something new, but build on your successes. In Alberta, we have a lot of oil, a lot of gas, and we have a lot of coal. And it would seem to me it would be a natural to be promoting more use of coal. Down in the United States, there's been a contest going on for about a year or so between Texas and one other state, vying for federal government money to build a coal-fired electrical plant with zero emissions. So we can do it. And we've got, they say, 1,000 years of coal in Alberta. So maybe we need to take a look more at technology with what we have got and build on our successes. I mean, there's lots of gas and oil in Alberta yet. I've got a son working in the business. You'd be amazed. And the technology they're using today will be totally obsolete within the next 10 years. It'll be a whole new system. Yep. And again, it's aiming at cutting the emissions. So I guess my question is, you know, you're talking the biomass in a big way, but what about the coal and what about nuclear power? That's an obvious.
As I said in the presentation, we need silver buckshot. There is no silver bullet, and certainly biomass is not a silver bullet. It will help to contribute, but I would say that coal will play a very important role in, as long as it's coupled to carbon capture and storage. And so I think there's a huge opportunity. One of the challenges of coal, and once you put carbon capture and storage in, you actually can increase the energy use, or as a matter of fact, the use of coal by up to 30%, because the extra cost associated with capturing and storing that carbon. So, you know, we're going to end up using more energy in order to do that, and I think that's fine as long as that is not adding to the environmental footprint. So I would agree with you that it's there, and as I said before, this is not an either or, it's an end. We need the coal. I think we need nuclear. We were talking at the table, and indeed we've been working NIC with a guy who's been come from NIC for the last 3 months from the Idaho National Laboratories, looking at the nuclear option in the oil sands and doing some reports for the government. I'm not sure it's got some significant challenges, and we can talk about some of those, not the least of which is the waste side, but I think that's probably, there are other challenges as well with nuclear in oil sands. But there may be some new technological breakthroughs that will reduce those. So yeah, I mean, I think we need all of these.
We're running to the end of our session here, and you've been an awfully good audience. Made the moderator totally superfluous. Didn't even get an opportunity to ask any questions, but we do have one more question from our new participant today, Joseph.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. I'm pleased to hear that the Pembina Institute is one of your partners, which is excellent. The concern I have, there's a few things here, but I'll just mention one, and that's riparian area harvesting, which to me is a big issue because riparian areas, as you know, are a very integral part of the whole ecosystem. And as soon as we start fooling around, and I believe in adaptation, and nobody mentioned the word adaptation, and I think that's another thing that the ecosystem does have a historically, the ecosystem has been here longer than we ever have. So we have to look at the natural processes more than I think we have. Thank you.
Good points. Well, thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Thank you very much, David. I think it's pretty hard to overemphasize the need of our society for energy, and I really would like to thank you for coming down from Calgary to tell us what our universities are doing to ensure that we have energy for future generations. Thanks, everybody.